From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And in Washington, that sound you'll hear later today is a can being kicked down the road. The House will vote on another short-term fix to keep the government open, this time until March 23rd, when Congress will vote all over again and will presumably already have voted on whether to extend DACA, the protection from deportation for some immigrants brought to the U.S. as children, because that deadline is earlier, March 5th. Also in Washington, what happens now after the House Intelligence Committee voted unanimously to declassify that memo from the Democrats rebutting the Republican accusations of wrongdoing in the Russian investigation? And what's the definition of treason after President Trump says Democrats committed it? NPR congressional reporter Kelsey Snell is here. Hi, Kelsey.
Hi there.
So Congress now putting forward its fifth short-term spending bill since Trump took office. What is in it?
Yeah, this is a short-term extension through March 23rd, as you mentioned, of most government funding. It also includes a one-year extension of all military funding. So that's something that's it hopes to appeal to conservatives who say that short-term spending bills are really bad for the military. It makes it hard for the Defense Department to plan. It makes it almost impossible for them to make long-term investments. So that would seem to shore up conservative votes. It also has a two-year extension of some medical programs, including funding for community health centers. That is intended to be a little bit bipartisan, but Democrats are not expected to vote for this, either in the House or in the Senate.
So what happens then? I mean, we're speaking as if this short-term extension is a fait accompli. Is it not?
Well, this short-term extension is probably a fait accompli in the House, but in the Senate, we're looking at a couple of different paths forward at this point. Democrats are needed. They need at least 9 Democrats to vote for any spending bill to get the 60 votes necessary in the Senate. Now, that doesn't look likely for this version, this House version of the bill. What's more likely to happen is that either they take the military spending portion out, the Senate repasses it and sends it over to the House for another vote, or it's entirely possible that in the next couple of days here that leaders could finally reach a long-term budget caps agreement that could be added on to this and then would go to the House for a vote, potentially paving the way for a couple of years of more harmony on budget and spending in Washington.
A couple of years? We have to wait. We want to talk about that memo from the Democrats, which contradicts the allegations made by the Republicans in their memo about abuses of surveillance power at the FBI. Now, many Republicans, most notably Trey Gowdy, are disputing the president's take that the Republican memo vindicated him in the Russia investigation. What's the talk in Congress about these dueling memos?
Well, it's important to say that while some people are disputing maybe the extent of the White House take, some Republicans are, there are plenty of Republicans up here who are saying that it impugns the FBI and that they're, you know, that it proves that there was meddling or wrongdoing on the part of the FBI. Now, there are a number of Republicans who still take that stance, though there are others who are walking a very fine line and saying that this is a discrete issue. What Gowdy said is that he said that he doesn't think it will impact the Russia investigation. He's been very careful about what he's said. Mm-hmm. Now, there are a number of reactions here. Democrats say the Nunes memo is just misrepresents the facts, and they're hoping and waiting for their memo to be released potentially in the next couple of days here.
Okay, because the president now has it and will be reviewing it. And by the way, the president stumped for his economic platform yesterday at a factory in Ohio. He did not acknowledge the tumbling stock market, but he did criticize Democrats who didn't stand and applaud at his State of the Union address.
They were like death. And un-American. Un-American. Somebody said treasonous. I mean, yeah, I guess why not? You know, can we call that treason? Why not?
Well, one reason might be that treason is a crime of betraying the country. What are people saying about that?
Well, obviously, Democrats are very mad. We've seen some coming out and saying that it's unacceptable for the president to throw around a word like treason in jest. We've heard some Republicans suggest that it was a joke. And there are other Republicans like Senator Jeff Flake, who's from Arizona and he's retiring this year, who said he tweeted today, "You don't always have to agree with those on the other side of the aisle, but all members of Congress love their country and none are treasonous." And then he linked to a story about that. So it definitely made some Democrats angry. That is absolutely for sure. There is a sense among Republicans that either they're defending Democrats in this situation or they're dismissing what the president said as a joke.
Yeah. NPR congressional reporter Kelsey Snell, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, an Iraqi government spokesman said this week that American troops are leaving Iraq now that ISIS has been defeated on the battlefield there. The AP reports that some U.S. forces are being transferred to Afghanistan, along with weapons and equipment. Joining us now is Kevin Barron, executive editor at Defense One. He's just back from a trip to the region, including Iraq. Kevin, welcome back.
Thank you.
And the headlines are making it sound like the U.S. is pulling out of Iraq. Is that what's happening?
Well, I think the headlines are jumping the gun a little bit. The war against ISIS in Iraq and Syria has come to a big changing point. You know, Mosul is liberated and Raqqa is liberated. So the commanders for the region are saying they don't need the same forces for those larger operations and are already starting to shift some of that equipment and attention over to Afghanistan, where President Trump has given the green light for a bit of a surge and a restart for that war.
Is there a worry that even if ISIS is losing territory, let's say in Iraq and in Syria, that the fighters may just go elsewhere and be a threat, you know, whether they go back to Turkey or where they came from or wherever it might be?
Yes, that's what the generals from the American side and the Iraqi side are really keeping an eye on right now. The question we asked over and over was, is there an insurgency or will there be an insurgency to follow? And we got mixed reviews from both sides and from within. Some said, yes, we're seeing the very start of it. Others saying, you know what, not really. What's not been as reported is that on the Iraqi side especially, special forces troops have gone back into places like Ramadi and Fallujah and Mosul to find any sleeper cells or remnants of ISIS that are trying to pop up and organize and connect and fund each other. They're really trying to keep their thumb on that to prevent an insurgency from coming up.
What did you find when you were in Iraq just now?
Well, I found that inflection point. The Iraqi generals there have said just a couple weeks ago they all agreed that they do want the United States to continue sending troops. They want more of them. But that exact number goes next to the prime minister, to a body, and then to the Americans to decide for themselves. But that first step is an important one. If you remember before the pullout of 2011, that was the major hitching point. The Iraqis themselves voted to send the Americans home.
Right.
They didn't want them to be there. So that's the next phase is, will the peace hold? How will Iraq bring in all the different fighting elements, some of which were sympathizing or aligned with Iran, to forge a restart of their future, a restart of the peace that was squandered in the last 3-4 years?
And what about Syria? The Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, indicated recently that there could be a long-term U.S. military presence in Syria. You were just there. What are you finding, and what is the American interest in Syria going forward?
You know, Syria is a far different place from Iraq. It's much more complicated. I think, yes, the Americans will be there, but in a much smaller way. The Americans have basically helped the Syrian Democratic Forces, the local group that they formed, to take over nearly half the country, if not more. This is supposed to lay the groundwork for peace, to let the Russians work it out with Assad and the regime, and all somehow magically end up in Geneva for a grand peace between all the sides for a coherent and still unified Syria. Until that happens, General Votel, the central commander for the region, says the United States will still be there. They will stick by the Syrian Democratic Forces. They will defend them and protect them against Turkey trying to insert itself into the Northwest. Until that Geneva process. That's the military's view of what the completion of the mission is.
You were in Raqqa in Syria, which is a city that was basically destroyed as ISIS was driven out. What did you see there?
It was remarkable. We flew in, and the American forces working with the Syrians together gave us a day tour, a driving tour through the city and walking through some areas, including former ISIS torture chambers and new schools that have started up. Frankly, I posted a video. It looks like Dresden in World War II. Hmm. It's block after block of total devastation with a handful of bulldozers provided by the State Department that are clearing some of the main roads just to drive around the city. What's needed is just an unbelievable Herculean effort, and that's what the top general went there to say, that the rest of the world needs to come together and help, even if they don't have the permission of Assad, even if this is a sovereign country. The Americans are there doing it alone, and that's not going to work. They're really worried that all of the gains that they made on the ground could be squandered if they don't have that backup on the post-conflict side.
I want to ask you finally about Afghanistan, which is, of course, America's longest war ever, heading towards 17 years. But you spoke with American military officials, and they are optimistic right now about actually winning that war.
Absolutely. I mean, the enthusiasm was a little surprising, to be frank. I've been there, been going there for many years. This time, there's a real different sense, a different vibe out there that, hey, we've had our hands tied for the last few years. We've been on the defense. Those have been our orders. Now, with Trump coming in and a new strategy, a new plan that, frankly, is more just a more robust version of the current plan that had existed, they think they can go on the offensive and they can once and for all put down what's left of the Taliban, work with an Afghan force that's a lot different than the original fledgling forces of 10 years ago, and make a difference. There's a whole lot of skepticism in Washington about that, but that's their orders and they're going forward.
That's Kevin Barron, who is executive editor at Defense One. Kevin, thanks as always.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Every day, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, ICE, sends about 240 people living in the U.S. illegally back to their countries of origin, and many turn right around and try to return. That's especially true for parents who often re-enter the states to get back to their families still living here. Reporter Liz Jones from member station KUOW in Seattle looks at the personal and financial costs of this revolving door of deportation. Her story begins at Mexico City's airport.
If you walk past all the shops at Mexico City's International Arrivals Terminal, in a far corner, you'll find a big sliding glass door marked with the letter N. This is a special exit where deportees walk out of security and back into Mexican life. Men start to trickle out the door, two or three at a time. They each carry a sack lunch with a juice box, a sandwich, and a cupcake inside. They're among 100 or so deportees who just walked off a chartered flight from Texas to Mexico City. Once past security, Gustavo Martinez makes a beeline for the payphones.
So who are you waiting for today?
My sister.
Is she on her way?
No.
Martinez lived in Utah 18 years. He's trying to call family in the States and in Mexico to let them know he's been deported. This airport is the handoff point for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. Three deportation flights land here every week, full of people arrested in the U.S.
What did you leave behind in Salt Lake City?
My daughters and everything.
How old are your girls?
13 and 6.
Martinez says he overstayed a visa and his ex-wife reported him to ICE. He plans to find a way back.
Do you think most people would try to cross again?
Si dejan su familia, sí.
If they leave their family, they're going to try again.
Así es.
That pull is increasingly common. Studies show more and more deportees have spent a long time in the U.S.
Hello, my name is Gustavo Lavariega. I'm in USA 17 years, Washington State, Walla Walla County.
Here to meet Martinez is Lavariega. He's a volunteer with a group called Deportees United. Its members greet passengers coming off these deportation flights every week. Many, he says, don't stay long.
Yeah, they come and buy a flight back to Tijuana and jump back.
Lavariega jumped back himself several years ago after ICE deported him to Tijuana. He tried to get to family in Mexico City.
But I don't have enough money. And then I have a couple guys with me. And we decide, well, let's go back, no? Let's go back to Washington. And the next day, boom, jump again, no?
Back then, his boss at a restaurant helped him with the trip. Lavariega lived in Washington 15 years. Then ICE found him again in 2016 and deported him back. Federal data show more than half the people deported from the U.S. in the past decade were deported more than once. And on average, ICE pays nearly $11,000 to deport each one. It raises questions in the U.S. about how to break this cycle and the cost to repeatedly deport these migrants, especially those with no criminal record.
The costs really add up.
Ben Geddes is with the American Action Forum, a center-right economic think tank. He co-authored a report in 2015 that asked, how much would it cost to deport all undocumented immigrants? He looked at big-ticket expenses.
Because it requires quite a bit of manpower, a lot of detention space, a pretty elaborate court system, which already has a significant backlog, and then, of course, transporting undocumented immigrants and require often chartered flights with agents on board.
Then there's the economic cost. Geddes says removing all undocumented workers will leave millions of jobs unfilled, even if Americans fill in the gaps. Overall, he argues for policy changes to allow more immigrants to live and work in the U.S. That's one way to address the revolving door. Another is with harsher penalties.
For those that continue to seek improper and illegal entry into this country, be forewarned. This is a new era. This is the Trump era.
That's U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions last April. He's directed prosecutors to crack down on people who reenter the country after being deported. Those convicted currently face up to 2 years in prison, but one proposal in Congress would bump it up to a maximum of 10 years. Back at the Mexico City airport, stiffer sentences for illegal crossings is fresh on the minds of two young deportees. They clear the gate, exhausted and shaken. We walked two nights in the desert, he says. Then they grabbed us crossing. I ask if they'll try again.
No, yeah, no.
Not now, they say. There's no job or family waiting up north. But for those who do make the crossing and find a job, their work experience is not lost on Mexican officials. The government recently ramped up efforts to get returned migrants back in the job market and keep them here. That's why Maricelia Anaya Flores is posted at the end door as deportees exit. She's with the Mexican Labor Department. Flores hands out pamphlets about unemployment benefits and job training. She's glad to welcome these deportees back, but she's no fan of U.S. immigration policy. I really don't know why they want to throw them out, she says. Trump should value them. My people are very hardworking. One person who's tapped into this government help is Ana Laura Lopez. She started the welcoming group, Deportees United, after she was deported from Chicago 2 years ago.
I remember the first time I arrived to Mexico. Nobody was here to receive me, to give me a hug, tell me, you are not alone. That's the reason we come every week here.
Lopez has a lot in common with many deportees who are trying to find some lawful way to get back to the U.S., back to their homes, and back to their children who are American citizens. Lopez has two teenage sons still in the U.S. I've lost all these months, she says, their graduation, to take them to school, to be with them. This is part of the price her family will pay, the emotional turmoil. This deportation is also a big financial hit for Lopez and her family.
Because it's really hard to find a job here. There are many discrimination against women, sometimes for age. It's hard to find opportunities here.
This frustration is what drove Lopez north in the first place, and she's determined not to stay in Mexico. She wants to save money, hire a lawyer, and try to fight her deportation case. That's her hope. But most days, she says she just feels stuck.
I don't have a plan. All my plans was in Chicago. All my life is in Chicago.
For Here and Now, I'm Liz Jones, reporting from Mexico City.
Well, now the question some of the 100 million people who watched the Philadelphia Eagles win the Super Bowl might be asking. Who is Meek Mill, and why did the Eagles take to the field to his 2012 song, Dreams and Nightmares? Hold on, wait a minute. Y'all thought I was finished. When I wore that ass tomorrow, y'all thought it was raining. Flexing on it. Well, some of the Eagles are joining others protesting what they see as an unfair prison sentence for this Philadelphia rapper. Jeremy Roebuck is a staff writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And Jeremy, Mill was put on probation in 2008 for carrying a gun. Then there were a string of rearrests on smaller things like popping a wheelie with a motorbike for violating probation. What's going on here?
Mill has been under probation for about a decade now since he was released from prison under that initial arrest. And just late last year, the judge that's been overseeing his probationary period decided after years of these violations and an arrest that you mentioned that she had had enough and ordered his incarceration, sentencing him to 2 to 4 more years in prison after these series of probation violations.
Well, some of them were, again, got into a fight at St. Louis Airport because someone wanted to take a selfie of him. He didn't want to do it. they seem like nonviolent infractions. For instance, he booked a show and was traveling out of state without the judge's permission, which has led some people to think what? What are the questions about the judge?
So what's really been interesting about this case is the public response. Mill, unlike a lot of defendants that go through the court system, has a pretty massive publicity machine led by his management company, which is owned by Jay-Z, and then a team of high-priced lawyers that their tactic in fighting back against this sentence has been, you know, let's throw the judge into question. Mill's lawyers have come out with a pretty astounding claim that, that she had tried to extort some personal favors from him during the period she was overseeing his probation, including that she wanted him to record a cover of a Boys to Men song that she liked and give her a shout-out in it. They've also alleged that she pressed pretty hard for him to switch managers to a local Philadelphia record producer that she was friendly with. But just recently, the judge, in response to some of those claims, unsealed a transcript of a meeting that showed that she didn't make any such claims. And in fact, it was a probation officer that had been really raising that issue in court.
Putting aside some of the questions about the judge, it sounds like this is an argument between those who say it's a probation, it doesn't matter, even if it's bopping a wheelie, you can't do it, and those who say this demonstrates what happens to young black men. They get picked up for, you know, lesser infractions than whites would and stay in prison longer. Just real quick, do the Eagles owners, has anyone objected to Meek Mill being such a big part of the Eagles team?
Not so much. I mean, I think it's clear that Meek Mill's case has caught the attention of a number of people, including people with a platform that want to provoke a larger conversation as to what his incarceration says about the criminal justice system in Philadelphia and how it treats black men and all defendants that are on probation for extended periods of time like him.
Well, you don't get a bigger platform than the Super Bowl. Jeremy Roebuck, staff writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, thank you.
No problem.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and punterful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
We are watching Wall Street today, and so is Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, who addressed the volatility in the stock market on Capitol Hill today.
I'm not overly concerned about the market volatility. I think the fundamentals are quite strong. I have checked in with market participants this morning before I came to make sure that there was orderly market activity, no systemic issues, and I'm happy to report that I got the green lights.
Mnuchin was speaking after the Dow fell nearly 1,200 points yesterday, its largest daily point drop in history. Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. He's with us now. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Jeremy.
And what do you make of Steven Mnuchin's comments today? I have to imagine that it's hard for an administration official to come out on a day when we see so big of a drop in the stock market the day after and try to reassure.
Well, I remember back to 2008, when the recession was getting going, and you would see the president, George Bush and Ben Bernanke, come out with some regularity. Administration do have to make a habit of talking about things when they're tough and not just when they're good, as this administration has been doing. But I think Mnuchin's right. When he says the fundamentals are in place, there are two things he's talking about. One is there isn't a technical problem like a flash crash, although there are still some questions about why the Dow was able to drop almost 1,000 points in the course of a few minutes yesterday afternoon.
Right.
But really, fundamentally, are there buyers? Are there sellers? Is there something happening that would cause a drop? And it really is a more orderly market than we've seen in the past. And if you look at today's activity on the market, it's the same idea. It's orderly. It's just that this market has needed a break, and it hasn't taken them at the normal intervals that a market normally does.
We also heard from the Trump administration today that they're going to release their big infrastructure plan on Monday. Is that release, do you think, connected to what we're seeing in the markets? Are they trying to distract?
I'll give them the benefit of the doubt. It might be a distraction to the upside. It might be, hey, we're on top of things. We've got ideas about how to make sure that both the tax cuts and the things that this government does are actually good for the economy and not just, you know, giving people money back. I don't think so. I think ultimately investors, smart investors, know what stocks should cost, and stocks got a little expensive. Stocks are priced based on the earnings that a company is going to make in the following year. And now with these big sell-offs, layoffs, stocks are priced at a more reasonable place. So it's like a sale, and you're seeing people saying, all right, the stocks that I was interested in are now on sale, so I'm going in to buy them. And then every time somebody buys and the market goes up a little bit, people sell off again to get out of it. So this is actually how a market's supposed to operate.
Why do you think that as stocks have fallen, that Bitcoin has also been losing a lot of value? At one point today, it was down 14%. Some people thought it was like the next gold. Maybe people would go to it when they didn't like what's happening in stocks.
Right. And I thought it was the next tulips, right, where it didn't make sense.
Right.
There are underlying technologies behind Bitcoin and the concept of blockchain that are really worthy of people learning about, and they can really make improvements to a number of functions that already exist. Things like cryptocurrencies are great for instant transactions, particularly for people in parts of the world where they don't have a credit card. But Bitcoin is way overvalued, and so are many of the other cryptocurrencies. And when the risk starts to come out of markets, you see people selling the riskiest types of investments, and that's what Bitcoin is.
Ali Velshi, not a member of the Bitcoin 100,000 Club.
That's right.
But yes, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Thank you so much.
This morning, President Trump tweeted about that undocumented immigrant twice deported from the U.S., accused of driving drunk this past weekend and killing two people, including Indianapolis Colts linebacker Edwin Jackson. On Twitter, Trump called it disgraceful and blamed Democrats for not keeping the border safe. Well, Republicans and Democrats remain far apart on just how to do that. Ahead of some looming deadlines, the threat of another government shutdown this week, and DACA, the Obama-era program that provides deportation protection for young immigrants brought here as children, which expires early next month. Today, White House Chief of Staff John Kelly said the president is not expected to extend that DACA deadline. Kelly said he doesn't think Trump has the legal authority to do so. Let's bring in Alfonso Aguilar, Executive Director of the Latino Partnership for Conservative Principles. He thinks President Trump is offering a compromise immigration plan everyone should rally around. He and other Hispanic conservatives met with Chief of Staff Kelly yesterday. Alfonso, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me. A pleasure to be with you.
And what do you think about the president's tweets today? This Guatemalan man was twice deported, driving drunk, kills two people. But a friend of Jackson's, his roommate, Chad Boucher, says Jackson wouldn't want his death politicized. He's asking the president to stop. And others point out that Trump is telling really falsehoods about immigrants committing crimes. They say immigrants commit fewer crimes than native-born citizens. And I just, are you, I mean, you're someone, for instance, who's very much in favor of protection, deportation protection for the DACA recipients. Do you worry that this kind of broad brushing paints them as well?
Certainly. I mean, I don't love that narrative. I think the majority of immigrants are good, hardworking people who are contributing to our nation and have no are not involved in criminal activity. However, I understand at the same time the frustration from the president and many other Americans. There are undocumented immigrants. It's a small minority, but there are involved in criminal activity. And when something like this happens, it's very frustrating. What happens is that the left tends to totally underestimate when undocumented immigrants are involved in criminal activity. But you know what? If we really care about immigrants and about dreamers, we have to forget about the narrative coming from left and right and really look at the policy proposals and what can we do from the policy perspective to get something done that's good for the country and good for the dreamers.
Well, let's do that. Let's look at the president's proposal. Oh, by the way, before that, though, I want to throw out another voice that's entered in because of this tweeting this morning. There are those who point to the thousands and thousands of drunk driving fatalities that are committed by American citizens who are drinking and driving, and they want the president to pay more attention to that as well. But putting that aside, let's talk about the president's plan that was presented a couple weeks ago. It calls for eventual citizenship for nearly 2 million young undocumented immigrants. More than the initial number of the Dreamers who were the first that were given this. There was an attempt to give them protection, and then the DACA recipients. Also, more money for the wall, a crackdown on illegal immigration, and a reducing of legal family-based migration, which critics call chain migration. Let's talk about that. Are you comfortable with that? The president's calling for just someone's spouse and minor children. That means that if someone comes over hardworking, here legally, and wants to bring, you know, family members, they can't bring a mother, an elderly mother, let's say. They can't bring older children. Is that really family reunification, which is what it originally was?
Look, I don't love cuts in legal immigration. I want to keep legal immigration levels as they are right now. But I recognize we need to compromise. Mm-hmm. However, having said that, Democrats are trying to say that this is some sort of draconian law that would massively reduce legal immigration. First of all, these legal cuts would take at least 15 years, in some visa categories, 5 decades to materialize. And even when they fully materialize, our country would still be receiving hundreds of thousands of legal immigrants. This is not going back to the 1920s when we had those very restrictive laws, basically imposed a moratorium on immigration. But that's what Democrats are trying to say. And it seems to me that they're fabricating excuses not to engage in a conversation.
Do you think, do you suspect, as others do, that Democrats are now doing this because they don't want a path for citizenship for DACA recipients or even deportation protection for DACA recipients to appear to come from a President Trump?
That's a reason, absolutely. But look, both parties will get credit if they can strike a deal on such a controversial and complex issue.
Well, but others are pointing out, and many of them are Republicans, who are lawmakers who live along the border. They are agreeing with the Democrats that the huge amount of money that's being asked for this wall is unrealistic, unnecessary in many parts. I mean, we heard the president say he didn't realize there were rivers, you know.
But to be fair, I mean, yesterday I had the pleasure, along with other top Hispanic leaders, to meet with Chief of Staff Kelly and with Secretary of Homeland Security Nielsen. And look, first of all, they're totally committed to the Dreamers. But in terms of the border, they understand that we're not going to have a 2,000-mile wall. The point that they're making is within this framework, within those four pillars that you outlined, they're willing to negotiate. But Democrats are just closing the door. There are no conversations based on the president's framework.
Well, you say the president's willing to negotiate. Some would say what he's doing is holding the Dreamers hostage. Why not? If the president really feels for these DACA recipients, why not just do that deal? Take this weight off their mind, not hold it as leverage.
I don't buy that argument because in the past, Democrats have proposed comprehensive immigration reform that included the undocumented immigrants, but other issues as well. So Republicans are doing the same. Look, I supported the Gang of Eight bill in 2013. It wasn't beautiful. I'm a conservative, but I thought we had to be practical. We had to get this ball rolling, this debate going on immigration. We had to work in a bipartisan way. And then when Republicans in the House didn't do anything, I criticized them. I think the same thing is happening this time around, but with Democrats. Hmm. We have the opportunity to provide not 690,000 people that benefited from DACA, but 1.8 million Dreamers, the possibility of a path to legal status and a path to citizenship. That's a great win for Dreamers. Mm.
Alfonso Aguilar, Executive Director of the Latino Partnership for Conservative Principles. And yeah. Alfonso, you've been on before. I just want to remind people, but also ask, you're an American citizen born in Puerto Rico.
Yes.
I was reading in a 2012 article how you attend St. Martin of Tours Catholic
yes.
Church, very strong Catholic beliefs. It sounds like you have deep respect for the, you know, comfort the strangers among us
yes.
thinking.
Yes.
You talked then about worshiping at that church with undocumented immigrants.
Right.
This parish is where there's a coming together. So you're sitting there working with undocumented immigrants. You know there are conservatives who say you should be calling ICE on them. What part of you is conservative about immigrants, undocumented immigrants?
Well, you know, I'm a Reagan conservative. I believe in the dignity of the human person. And when I see individuals, hardworking people that are coming here not for social benefits, but to work hard, to contribute to this country, and that they're people of faith, that actually they defend conservative principles like the right to life, freedom of religion, the importance of the family. There's a lot of ignorance in the conservative movement about undocumented immigrants and minorities and Hispanics in general.
But if deportation of undocumented immigrants is increased, as many backers of Donald Trump would like to see, should ICE come to your church or someone else's church?
But the reality is that it's not happening. I know Democrats are saying that there are campaigns to massively deport people. That is just not happening. And we did talk a little bit about that yesterday with Secretary Nielsen. The priority is to go after people with criminal records, and that's exactly what is happening. Mm. But, you know, Hispanics are working. They're going to school. I mean, immigrants, undocumented immigrants, going to school, working. And they realize that a lot of this is noise, that, you know, they are living their lives, that nobody's coming after them. They know that there's some people who are undocumented, who are involved in criminal activity, and those people give the entire community a bad name. Mm. But I think at the end they want solutions.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All righty. Take care. Bye-bye.
And again, Alfonso Aguilar, Executive Director of the Latino Partnership for Conservative Principles. By the way, he told us he doesn't expect a breakthrough on immigration this week or next, but he thinks Republicans will be able to pass that short-term spending deal the House is voting on later today. As we said a bit ago, this will kick the government funding question down the road to March 23rd. Alfonso says that will give lawmakers the chance to negotiate the DACA extension before it expires a couple weeks earlier on March 5th. It might also take DACA out of the spending negotiations. We'll see.
By now, if you've taken an Uber or a Lyft, you're familiar with dynamic pricing, charging more or less for the same ride depending on how much demand there is. Well, now a restaurant in London is trying out a similar model. It's a place called Bob Bob Ricard, and joining us now is Leonid Shutov, the owner and founder. Leonid, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much.
And why did you decide to do dynamic pricing in a restaurant?
Well, it's a very competitive environment, and the times have changed, yet the restaurants, certainly the luxury restaurants, remain firmly back in the 20th century. It was simply time for us to embrace the modern world.
So how does it work at your restaurant?
It's a fairly straightforward thing. Our entire a la carte menu exists at three price levels. In a nutshell, there's a regular menu, which is a normal price as it always existed. There's a mid-peak menu, which is roughly 15% below our regular prices, and another off-peak menu, which is roughly 25% below. And this would apply across the menu.
And what counts as mid-peak times and off-peak times?
Very simply speaking, lunches tend to be less than dinners, and then beginning of the week tends to be less than the weekends. So to give you an example, on Saturday, lunch would be mid-peak, and then dinner would be regular. And on Monday, both lunch and dinner would be off-peak.
So what's the difference between this and an early bird special, which has been around forever?
Yeah, well, the famous Florida early bird special.
Right.
It's quite different in the sense that, A, the entire menu is priced differently. We're a special occasion restaurant, so people don't come to us because they're hungry. People come to us because they're looking to celebrate. And we give people options if their dates are flexible.
Now, some people are looking at what you're doing and comparing it to Uber. But of course, Uber does surge pricing where they raise the price at peak times. You're not raising the price at any time, right? You're just lowering the
Correct.
Price at off-peak times.
We are a very different industry. Restaurants are probably the most competitive industry out there. We rely on public opinion. We rely on our customers wanting to come to us. We can never really take advantage of them because they will never forgive. They'll never return. All we're doing is we're saying on days when there's less demand generally for high-end luxury restaurants, we'll give you a reason to consider coming to us on those times.
So just give me an example of what a meal would cost in the middle of the day versus at dinner time.
An average meal, our average check at Bob Bob Ricard is about £100. But one of the interesting findings that we have is that our customers, when they come in on off-peak days, they're not necessarily looking to spend less. They're looking to get more for the full budget. Mm. So our average checks have not changed in any meaningful way on those days because the customers are rewarding themselves with more special things, with a bit of caviar, with a little bit more champagne than they may have had otherwise.
How has it affected business so far?
It's been very, very positive. We're very excited about results. We can see a massive increase, certainly on off-peak times. And our covers on our quietest days have nearly doubled.
Have you heard from any other restaurant owners in London that want to do the same thing?
Well, we've been talking to, obviously, lots of our friends and lots of our colleagues in the industry. And I think at this stage, most of them are watching rather than embracing it. They want to give it a bit more time. In high-end restaurants, in luxury restaurants, nobody wants to be doing the brave thing. We all prefer to follow things that have become an industry norm.
Well, and actually, one of the things that is not an industry norm that is happening at your restaurant and has been happening, it's not just the dynamic pricing, it's something else. I was there, and I remember this. You have a button at every table that says press for champagne.
Correct. That's what we do. And we sell more champagne than any other restaurant in the UK.
Wow. Everybody just has to do it, right? You come in, you go to Bob Ricard, you've got to get your champagne.
That's part of the experience. That's part of what people come in for.
And what do you charge for the champagne?
We have a very substantial list of champagne, but our house champagne, which is a phenomenal Grand Cru Ayala, is £13.50 for a glass.
How often do you have champagne? And do you have one of those buttons back in the kitchen?
Well, that would be a very dangerous thing indeed. But champagne is an occupational hazard for me. To be entirely honest, I have it virtually daily, at least a little bit.
Wow.
So it's one of the perks.
How did you come up with the press for champagne idea?
Oh, it was a long time ago, and it was probably one of those times when we had a bit too much champagne ourselves to start with.
Okay. That's Leonid Shutov, who is the owner and founder of the London restaurant Bob Ricard. Leonid, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, and hope to see you sometime soon.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service, music courtesy of APM.
It's Here and Now.